Okay, yes. So thank you, Ido. As Ido said, I'm going to talk a little bit about the electromagnetic transients that are associated with neutron star mergers and just kind of all the physics that goes into both understanding what kind of signal is produced and, you know, how we can interpret that signal to really maximize the extraction of knowledge from these events, you know, whenever we're lucky enough to get another one, hopefully soon. So some of this is going to be a slight retread of things that we heard, you know, from Daniel and earlier this morning from Andy, but I'm going to make an effort to kind of really contextualize it in terms of the transient signal and connect to observations as much as I can. Okay, so the first thing I think I want to do is just define a kilonova. This is probably not a definition that's too surprising to anyone in the audience, but just to be very clear, kilonovae are radioactive transients that are powered by the decay of elements that are produced by rapid neutron capture. So we know that, you know, in a compact object merger, assuming at least one of the compact objects is a neutron star, we get some mildly relativistic unbound material, and the conditions in this material allow for the synthesis of heavy, unstable nuclei. And later these nuclei are going to decay, and the energy from these decays is going to heat up the cloud and power an electromagnetic transient, sort of like a mini supernovae. So as Daniel introduced in the last talk, we know that we have a couple of different modes of mass ejection that are available to us, but you know, in all of these cases, we can describe the outflows that we get as mildly relativistic unbound material that's being heated by the R process. So this is the system that we want to understand. And when I think about understanding kilonovae, there we go. I like to think about it in terms of three questions. So, you know, how much material do we have? How fast is it moving? And what kind? What is it made up of? And these seem kind of, you know, simple when I write them out like this in the middle of an empty slide, but you know, they actually, these kind of are represent the intersection of a lot of different physical processes that are at play. So let's complicate the picture a little bit. When we talk about how much and how fast, the answers to those two questions really depend on the interaction of a couple of different things. So the first is the ingredients that we start with. What are the component stars? You know, what are their masses? What is the binary type? Is it a neutron star or a neutron star black hole merger? So, you know, that kind of sets the initial conditions. And then, of course, you know, exactly how the ejecta is launched and what properties it has is going to depend on the neutron star equation of state, which mediates how the two stars interact with each other's gravitational field and what's going to happen when they ultimately collide at the end of their long coalescence. The question of what kind has to do with the nucleosynthesis that we get out of the merger. And this depends both on the post-merger environment, so exactly what is going on, you know, with the weak interactions in the aftermath of the merger, as well as some unknown nuclear physics, in particular the properties of nuclei, like the beta decay rates, the neutron capture cross-sections, the nuclear masses, far from stability, specifically on the neutron-rich side of stability. And then just to add an extra layer of complexity, as was kind of hinted at in Daniel's talk, sorry, clickers are new to me, as was kind of hinted at in Daniel's talk, you know, exactly what's going on in the post-merger environment is itself a product of the neutron star equation of state and the component stars, because the sort of the environment that is produced that will allow different kinds of nucleosynthesis depends on what the merger remnant is, what kind of a disk is formed, and, you know, just how weak interactions are able to alter the initial composition of the gas as it prepares to undergo an R process. So this is good news and bad news, right? The bad news is that there are a lot of things that we have to deal with if we really want to understand the full population of kilonovae in all of their complexity. But the good news is that if we can figure out how to interpret these signals, that's going to give us an entry point to understanding a lot of different and exciting areas in astrophysics. Okay, so I'm actually going to proceed in reverse order through all of these questions. So I'm going to start by talking about what kind of material we produce. And it turns out that, you know, even though the R process is quite complicated, we actually have one, and hopefully we're developing an increasing number of tools of increasing quality to address this question of the composition burned in a kilonova event. Okay, a very brief reminder of the R process that I assume most people in this room don't need, but just in case, you know, the R process produces a really broad array of elements that kind of fall, you know, all over the bottom half of the periodic table. So we produce a wide range of some of the heaviest elements that we observe in the universe, and we do that by, or the R process does that, By capturing free neutrons onto seed nuclei and creating heavier and heavier, more and more neutron-rich, and therefore more and more unstable nuclei, and these are later going to decay, and supply the energy that powers the kilonova light curve, and kind of fill out the regions in purple here on the periodic table. All right, so one thing that is very interesting about at least a handful of elements that are produced by the R process is that they have a very high opacity, right? So people who model transients can tell you that opacity just measures how difficult it is for photons to move through material. So a higher opacity means it's harder for these photons to diffuse. They're going to stay trapped in a high opacity system longer than they would in a low opacity system. So here we are plotting synthetic expansion opacities for a handful of the elements that are produced by the R process, as well as for iron, which we plot for comparison both because it's a very well-documented system and because it supplies the bulk of the opacity in supernovae, so it's a useful benchmark for thinking about how these signals from kilonovae might compare to more familiar radioactive transients. Okay, and what you can see if you look at these opacities is that not all R process elements, but a handful of R process elements have an opacity that is much, much higher than some of these more familiar species like iron. So in particular, we found that opacity is not really a function of mass, it's instead a function of atomic structure. So lanthanides and actinides, which I'll just go back and remind you, which are these elements that fall in the bottom two rows of the periodic table and have their valence electrons in a large open F shell, happen to have a much higher opacity than elements that are located elsewhere in the periodic table. And this is just due to atomic complexity, right? The larger valence shell means there are more ways to rearrange valence electrons. That corresponds to having more energy levels, and so, you know, more ways to move from one energy level to another. And since bound-bound opacity is really just a reflection of how easily a photon can be absorbed by an atom and excite that atom's electrons into a higher energy configuration, this increased complexity just translates to a higher opacity. All right, and the effect of this higher opacity on light curves and spectra is actually pretty profound, as you can see in these results of one-dimensional radiation transport simulations that were carried out with the time-dependent Monte Carlo radiation transport code Sedona. So I'm showing bolometric light curves and spectral snapshots for a suite of models that are the same in every respect except for their composition. So, we kind of took a spherically symmetric explosion model and we took a composition and then we just artificially increased the lanthanide mass fraction and we looked at what effect that had on the light curves and spectra. Okay, and you can see, as I promised, it's pretty profound, right? As we dial up the lanthanide fraction, thereby increasing the opacity, we see that our bolometric light curves are elongated and they become dimmer. If we look at the spectra, what we see is that the emission is shifted to redder wavelengths. And there's some kind of intuitive physical arguments you can make for why these effects should appear this way. The main one is that as we increase the opacity, we're again making it harder for these photons to diffuse out. And so, if it takes longer for the photons to get out of the system, that's going to lengthen the light curve. Since the photons spend more time trapped in an optically fixed system as it expands and eventually becomes less and less opaque, they lose more of their energy to adiabatic expansion while the system is in its optically thin phase. So, you know, even once the system does become optically thin, a lot of that energy has been degraded, and the result is a dimmer light curve. So this adiabatic cooling is partly responsible for the reddening that we see when we look at the spectrum, but the reddening is actually enhanced by very strong line blanketing at optical wavelengths. So it's just really hard for photons with optical wavelengths to ever make their way out of the ejecta. So, you know, in order to escape, they have to wait until some process has redistributed them to lower energies and redder wavelengths, and that's when they're finally able to escape the system and be observed by us as a spectrum. Okay, so this connection between nucleosynthesis and the color of the kilonova emission is extremely useful. First of all, it's useful because it gives us a way to diagnose the presence of R process produced elements in a merger, right? If we see some signal that has a long dim light curve and anomalously red emission, that's pretty compelling evidence that an R process occurred in this event. But actually, it's even more useful than it might appear at first. And that's because the outcome of the R process is variable, right? So often we talk about the R process and we think about solar R process abundances, and we just sort of assume it's one single monolithic process, but that of course is not the case. The outcome of the R process can actually vary a lot depending on initial conditions, for one thing. So that's what's shown in this plot here. These are final abundance patterns for different R process simulations that were carried out using Jonas Lipner's R process nuclear reaction network code, which is called Skynet. So in R process simulations, it's common to parameterize initial conditions in terms of three variables, entropy per baryon, expansion timescale, and electron fraction YE, which is just the number of protons per baryon. So somewhat counterintuitively, the higher your YE is, the fewer free neutrons you have around, and vice versa. So in this set of simulations, entropy and expansion timescale have been set at kind of reasonable values, and YE has been allowed to vary. And you can see that allowing YE to vary actually has a pretty strong effect on the final abundances that you get out in an R process event. As long as YE is sufficiently low, it's very easy for the R process to burn the heaviest elements that it's capable of making, right? We reach, you know, all the way up here to the third peak and beyond. You produce elements like uranium and plutonium. You make plenty of the high-opacity lanthanides and actinides, the positions of which are indicated by this like light blue bar here. But if you continue to dial up the YE, so you're reducing that supply of free neutrons, eventually you're going to run into problems. So in this particular set of simulations, a YE of about 0.5 emerges as a threshold. And you know that can vary slightly depending on the nuclear physics models that you put in. But just thinking about it kind of, you know, intuitively, you can probably convince yourself that if you reduce your supply of free neutrons, eventually it's going to become very difficult to make the high opacity lanthanides and actinides and the other heavy elements that the R process can produce given the right conditions. Okay, so when we think about a kilonova or the aftermath of a neutron star merger, So what YE is telling us is that the outcome of the R process can vary depending on the number of free neutrons per seed that we have around. As you know, as we heard earlier, number of free neutrons per seed is really a sign of weak interactions. So weak current interactions are the way that the originally very neutron-rich material ejected in the course of a neutron star merger can be transformed into less neutron-rich material that would be less capable of producing all of these heavy elements. So what we're really measuring here is, you know, weak interactions that are at play in the aftermath of the merger. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have multiple components that are probably present in the kilonova ejecta, and we actually expect these different components to suffer or to be exposed to different levels of weak interactions. You know, we would expect material that's squeezed out of the contact interface between two neutron stars as they crash together to undergo shock heating and a lot of neutrino irradiation and electron-positron pair production and subsequent capture. And we would expect this to be fairly low YE. Any tidally stripped material that would mostly occur in a neutron star black hole merger should be very neutron rich, should kind of be in this low YE, heavy R process regime, and then disk outflows, depending on the central remnant, can fall in either of those two categories. But what we've really established with this work is the idea that the color of the kilonova emission can tell us something about the composition, and we can actually use that not only to tell whether or not R process elements are produced, but to try to diagnose the presence or the prevalence of different components, and therefore get a much more complete picture of the neutron star merger and the masses that it ejected. Okay, so I will try to go over quickly and hopefully clearly exactly how that might work. Those of you who were here a couple of weeks ago, have seen this slide before. Let's take another crack at it. So this is just a kind of an outline showing exactly how a merger could proceed, depending on the, you know, the binary type. So you have, you know, a neutron star or a neutron star black hole. You can have these different modes of mass ejection. You're going to probably end with some kind of accretion disk. And depending on, you know, exactly what happens with the central remnant, you're going to have a long-lived neutron star central remnant or prompt collapse to a black hole. Okay, but we said weak interactions are important to thinking about the final outcome of the R process. So weak interactions are going to be most important in this dynamically squeezed case, as we talked about, and in a disk surrounding a long-lived neutron star central remnant, because you're going to have irradiation from that central remnant. Okay, But the ability of the system to actually, produce the neutrinos and electrons and positrons that drive these interactions, oh boy, are going to be dependent on the neutron star equation of state, right? So in particular, tidal shredding is easier to achieve in the case that you have a less compact equation of state. The neutron star is easier to shred. In contrast, dynamical squeezing is going to be favored by a more compact equation of state because you're going to have a more violent collision and a more, energetic outflow from that contact interface. And then what happens with the central remnant of the central remnant after a merger is related not so much to the compactness of the equation of state, but to the maximum mass. So, there's this complex interplay between equation of state and the binary properties that really determine how weak interactions are allowed to proceed in the aftermath of a merger, and that is ultimately going to be reflected in the kinds of emission that we get from a kilonova. Okay, so I apologize, I appear to have timed this poorly, so I'm going to pick up the pace a little bit and hopefully still finish before Ido flashes the please stop talking sign. Okay, all right, I want to say one, this is kind of the simplest one, the second question, how fast? So as one important piece of information to know is how fast these different components are moving, because that can be related, that can help us relate different components of the emission to different components of the kilonova. But luckily that's pretty straightforward because we can just look at absorption features. So as will be familiar to anyone who studies the spectra from kilonova or supernovae, we see some absorption features in the signal. The faster the material is flowing out, the more these features are smeared out and blended together. That's illustrated pretty nicely in this plot. As long as everything's moving slowly, you can see these nice clear spectral features. As the gas starts to move faster and faster, these get spread out and blended together. So by the time we reach the upper by the time we reach the upper range of what we might expect, it's very hard to discern any particular absorption features at all. Okay, and so just based on sort of physical arguments, we expect the gas of any given component to reflect the escape velocity in the case of the disk or the tidal ejecta. So, and then in the case that we have this dynamical ejecta from the two neutron stars crashing together, that's going to have a very high velocity just because of the violence of the collision. So based on what we see in the spectra, we can kind of try to diagnose which components of the emission or we can guess at a velocity of different emission components. And we can use that to try to make an identification of the source of the emission. Okay, the final thing I want to talk about is how we're going to measure the ejecta mass, which turns out to be straightforward, but with pretty, straightforward conceptually, but with pretty large error bars. So in a radioactive transient generally, we can think about getting some luminosity that corresponds to the amount of radioactive mass. So radioactive mass is going to produce energy, that's going to form a light curve. An additional complication to this picture is that not all of the energy from radioactivity is going to be converted into photons. So only some of that material is actually going to get converted into the luminosity that we can observe. So it's not enough just to know, how much energy is produced from radioactivity. We also need to have an understanding of the efficiency with which that radioactive energy is converted into the thermal energy that we observe as a light curve. Okay, so in the R process, this question of efficiency is particularly complicated because the R process itself is complicated. We often think about beta decay when we think about the R process, but there are other decay channels that happen, and exactly how energy is divided between these decay channels, and exactly what the emission profile and what the emission profiles are, and the absolute amount of energy that are emitted, all have to do with details of nuclear physics. Okay, in my last remaining minute, I think the point I will try to impress upon you is that there's just a lot of variance in both how much energy we get out of the R process and in how efficiently that energy thermalizes. And we can divide this variance into kind of two categories. So the first is has to do with astrophysical conditions, right? So even if we understood everything about R process nucleosynthesis, we had perfectly measured masses and beta decay rates and neutron capture cross sections, we still know that, neutron star our compact object mergers are not going to be perfectly standardized. We're going to get different kinds of binaries merging, and this is going to produce different astrophysical conditions that's going to lead to a different kind of R process from system to system. The second category is, are these nuclear uncertainties? So, okay, that's good, that's fine. I will stop talking after I say that, the theoretical inputs that we use to do these R process calculations are not constrained far from stability where they matter for the R process. So we need to have, when we think about using total luminosity to measure the ejected mass in the system, we really need to be thinking about all of the variation that you can get in the radioactive energy generated per unit mass from the R process and folding that uncertainty into our mass estimates. So. Okay, yes, I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
So, Jenny, if you can go back to your slide where you were trying to distinguish between what happens to neutron star black hole versus neutron star neutron star. I think maybe a few slides ago. But basically, my question is, can you have a lanthanide poor blue component even for a neutron star black hole?
Oh.
Or is it only always just the dynamical?
So I think for a neutron star black hole merger, it depends on the mass ratio, right? There are definitely cases where you get no kilonova because you have the neutron star just being swallowed whole by the black hole without any tidal shredding. I think in the case that you... Right. I think in the case that you have tidal shredding, that's pretty robustly going to be like a cold, low entropy R process that should give you lanthanide richness. There's maybe some question, like if you form an accretion disk under the right conditions, maybe, and some people who model these disks should feel free to speak up because you have more expertise on the subject than I do. I can imagine a scenario where, you have some kind of disk and maybe it's, I think it would be hard. You would have to have self-irradiation of the disk by neutrinos, and I think that would probably require some pretty particular conditions.
I think there may be some very early phase when the accretion rate is high where maybe the neutrinos can raise the YE. I think the general expectation is there may be a blue component, but it might be less mass and it might be lower velocity because we think the disk winds are probably slower than what the dynamical is squeezing. So I think it's possible. I don't think we can rule it out, but I think the general expectation is the red component should be relatively stronger.
Can you comment on, are there other things that can strongly affect what are seen in the light curves in terms of like the geometry of the system or the like asymmetry or the structure of the matter that's coming out, the profile of it?
Yes, although, I'll give a general answer first, which is that we do kind of expect a generic kilonova to have asymmetry. So yes, its signal should vary with viewing angle. I think it's slightly hard to go from that to saying this is what we expect the asymmetry to be. And, so that kind of creates a tension where it's very important to explore, models of three-dimensional kilonovae that do exhibit strong asymmetry. At the same time, it's very challenging to construct models in a way that, is physically motivated and unique, if that makes sense. I think, people who do this work really, really make an effort to tie their models, usually to like numerical relativity simulations, but I think there are still challenges, in figuring out what the most likely configuration is going to be. Specifically, there has been some interesting work doing multidimensional kilonova modeling, some of which has kind of focused on the more like standard interpretation of the kilonova signal, which is this blue polar ejecta and a red disk outflow, and some of which has looked at almost the exact opposite of that system, a blue disk surrounded by a red kilonova, and they all claim that they can get reasonable matches to GW170817 or its electromagnetic counterpart. So yeah, I would say that's still like a very active area of exploration. And one thing that's really going to help is just getting more events, being able to, you know, get a 360, or I guess a 4π view of what these systems look like. And then, you know, hopefully we'll get a sense at least of like whether they all are kind of standard or whether you have different geometries at play. But it's, yeah, it's definitely an important question, but challenging, I think, to know exactly how the model should be set up.
So one of your three questions is how fast, but I think of that as being like bulk expansion velocity.
Yes.
But how tricky is the question of, you know, within the outflow that, I mean, you, to get these nuclear reactions, you have to have interaction. So I'm thinking, you know, there's relative velocities, there's essentially the temperature of the outflow,
yeah,
something like that. How tricky is that to model, or, you know, how sensitive to how it's the outflow is generated, say?
Right, so the relevant nuclear reactions where you're actually assembling the heavy nuclei happen very early on, and then the kilonova occurs much later. So, you know, like for example, in the disk, you know, you kind of have this very dense gas in the disk surrounding the central remnant, and then you launch a wind, but all of the, you know, what sets the stage for the nucleosynthesis is going to happen in less than a second. And then on kilonova timescales, you really just have the decay, which doesn't care about how fast you're moving or like any of these, you know, you don't have any like capture cross sections or any three-body interactions or anything like that. So, yes, I think just because the nucleosynthesis kind of happens in a different like hydrodynamic regime than where the explosion is when it's generating the signal that becomes the kilonovae, those are kind of decoupled. If that makes sense. Yeah.
It'd be lovely to identify individual lines and
yes,
really get the elements.
Are
there places, for example, in the mid-infrared, maybe observable with JWST, where you would expect a much lower wavelength density of lines, and therefore you might have a chance at seeing individual lines?
Oh. Yeah, I guess I have not thought specifically about wavelength dependence and how it would influence the probability of finding lines. You're definitely right that since the opacities are lower in the mid-infrared, the probability that there would be a strong line there is greater, and certainly based on the spectra that we saw from the one good example of a kilonova that we had, there did appear to be some prominent features there. So I think there's still a question of, one, just blending, you know, are we going to see particular lines, or are we really going to see like clusters of lines and the effects of multiple overlapping lines? And then again, there's just this question of, you know, you can make an argument that this line is, you know, some ion of element X, but how it's harder, I think, to rule out that it couldn't possibly be, you know, some other ion of element Y, Z, or Q, or whatever. There is some cool work that I'm aware of, but that I think has not been published, so I won't speak about it in too much detail, but I know people have been looking at trying to identify particular lines. Although I think an additional challenge to that is that we use synthetic atomic data to construct our opacities, and that's very good for establishing kind of the statistical distribution of lines in wavelength space, as well as what the overall continuum opacity is, but it's a little bit harder, I think, to validate that it would predict, you know, a particular you know, the one line that's important to spectral formation at like 1 micron or something like that. So that probably needs to be a dialogue between like theory and experiment and observation.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, so I was just going to make a comment on the lines, but I think you said everything I was going to say. If we had the right ejecta, and we were viewing it in such a way that there wasn't as much line smearing as we normally get, there are some lines like in neodymium that might be visible, but it really takes a series of lucky situations. Otherwise, a lot of these lines start to, you know, they blend, like you said, and so
okay,
it's hard to do. And then you also said the comments of synthetic spectra, line
right,
positions are hard, so.
Okay.
And
right,
I think
well,
there is
thanks,
exciting prospects, so I think we need to look at it, but it's going to be harder than I would like it to be.
Okay, but I should just say you should make predictions quickly before the launch of JWST so that you can claim that you've predicted the locations of lines. Anyway, thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.